Hello, everybody. If you're here for a panel on the 1998 World Series, you're early and you're in the wrong room. This is about the 1984 season, and we have a really good group here to discuss it. Let me first make a couple of announcements. If you have a question, any questions you want to ask, unlike when Josh Stein was up here and you had the microphone, we have cards. Fred, where are you? Fred has cards. You just write your question on that. He'll bring them up the last 20 minutes or so, and we'll ask those questions. And number two, for any of you who don't know, California is staging an earthquake test at 11 o'clock this morning. And if your cell phone is on at 11 o'clock, you may be electrocuted. I mean, it's going to start going off. And it might get a little loud in here. So I just turned mine off, but that's going to happen at 11 o'clock. If you want to see what it sounds like, I guess you can leave it on. Might be kind of fun. Anyway, this is the panel on the 1984 season. My name is Bob Chandler. I was a broadcaster for the San Diego Padres then. Broadcast the games for over 30 years with some great people, including Jerry Coleman, who's in the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame now, a great guy. A war hero as well as a great player. And this unique panel, before I introduce them, let me say the Padres, to say they didn't have immediate success might be a little bit of an exaggeration. They began in 1969 as an expansion team with the Montreal Expos. Ironically, both teams that year won 52 games and lost 110. It took the Padres until their 10th season, 1978, before they finally had a winning season. They won 84, they lost 78. Roger Craig was the manager. That 78 team actually had four Hall of Famers on it. Gaylord Perry, who was a starting pitcher, won the Cy Young Award that year at the age of 40, said he dedicated his award to all the 40-year-olds. 11 of his 21 wins were saved by Raleigh Fingers, who's also in the Hall of Fame. The shortstop was the Wizard, Ozzie Smith, and the right fielder was Dave Winfield. So all four of those guys are in the Hall of Fame. So 78, they finally had a winning record. They didn't have another winning record until 1984. And then something happened that will never happen again, because you only get to the World Series for the first time once. And for the Padres, that was 1984. And so we have unique people who can comment on that. Ballard Smith, to my right, was the president of the team that year. He was working for a fellow by the name of Ray Kroc. If you've ever had a McDonald's hamburger, you should know about Ray Kroc. Unfortunately, Ray had died in January of that year, but that season was dedicated to Ray Kroc. Anyway, Ballard was his son-in-law. He was the president of the team. He was involved in signing a couple of free agents you've probably heard of, Steve Garvey in 1982, and then Goose Gossage in 1984. Next to Ballard is Ron Rappaport, one of the great sports writers of our country. And in 1984, he was the sports columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. And if you remember 1984, there was an epic playoff series between the Padres and the Cubs that year. Next to him, Bill Center. Bill is probably the most versatile sports writer I've ever known. I mean, he not only has covered baseball, started working for the San Diego Union in 1967. He learned baseball under a Hall of Fame baseball writer named Phil Collier and shared duties with Phil that year. But he also was the motorsports writer for the Union, San Diego Union. He also was involved in boating. San Diego was big in boating back in the 80s. You had the America's Cup and Dennis Conner, and Bill was right in the middle of that. He covered hockey. He's covered boxing. He's done a little bit of everything. Now he's a Padre historian, and we'll talk to him about San Diego in 1984. And on the far right is the one guy who was more involved in that 84 team than anybody, because he was a player on that team. He turned out to be the Padre hero as such in the World Series. The World Series, they lost 4-1. Might have been 4-0 if it hadn't been for Kurt Bavacqua. There was an epic beanball war in August between the Padres and the Atlanta Braves, the worst I've ever seen. Kurt was right in the middle of that. He was a key pinch hitter on that team, so he's uniquely qualified to talk about the 84 Padres. So I thought we should begin with the guy who was the president and really got things going when he hired a fellow named Jack McKeon as general manager in 1980. And a couple of years later, Dick Williams, a controversial manager, but was the first manager to lead the Padres to a World Series, signed Steve Garvey and Goose Gossett. So, Ballard, what made you hire Jack McKeon in 1980?
Well, you might remember, Bob, Jack had been with the club, and he was an assistant general manager, Bob Fontaine. And we'd gone out and made a pretty extensive search of other possibilities. But we just felt that Jack, based on the contribution that he'd made to the team up to then, was going to be the best person. He understood the organization, and we thought he was the best one to make the transition from Bob Fontaine.
And then Dick Williams, was it you and Jack who were involved in hiring Dick Williams?
Jack was not thrilled about Dick Williams being hired as manager. For those of you that know Jack, one of his goals in life was he wanted to be the manager. Dick was a pretty controversial guy, and even though he'd had tremendous success with Montreal and Red Sox and with the with the A's, his modus operandi was to leave not necessarily on good terms. And shortly before we made the decision to hire him, I'd gotten a call from Charles Brofman with the Montreal Expos, and I wanted to talk to him about Dick. He said, "I'm going to tell you something. He's probably the best manager I've ever seen. You're going to have some success with him, but I don't care if you go to the World Series. You're going to call me back someday and tell me you wish you hadn't hired him." I think Dick was a brilliant manager, and you probably ought to ask Kurt about that. Kurt and I have talked about it, and there's quite a few players that played for him that have ended up managing and coaching. And I don't know that I'd go as far as to say, "I'm sorry we hired him," but we certainly ran into rough waters at the end of his time with the Padres.
You know, I'll ask Kurt about this, but I do remember Tim Flannery was saying he learned more baseball from Dick Williams than anybody ever in his career, but that there are times that if he saw him walking across the street, he'd want to run him down. San Diego in 1984, it was a magical season. They won 92 games, and they picked a good year to have a good season because no other team in the National League West that year had a winning record. And the Padres ended up winning by 12 games. But there's nothing like a pennant race to capture the imagination of a city. And although I was with the team and broadcasting, so I wasn't there walking along the beach, but I'm told that you could walk along the beaches of San Diego that summer and not miss a pitch because everybody had their transistor radios out and you could hear everything about that season. It was a magical year. And I'm gathering it was pretty much the same in Chicago. Now, Ron Rappaport, you were there, and I'm guessing you wrote a lot of columns about the Chicago Cubs that year. But, I mean, they hadn't been in the World Series since 1945.
Well, I was writing columns, and I went back and looked at some of them. And it was really an amazing time in Chicago. Can I just say that it's an honor to be with these guys, and I'm a little intimidated. The last panel I was on was at the L.A. Book Fest for a book I'd written about Ernie Banks that just came out. And on one side of me was a professor named Douglas Blight from Yale who'd written a biography of Frederick Douglass, the great black pioneer. And on the other side was a man named Jeffrey Stewart, a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who'd written a book about Elaine Locke, the leader of the Harlem Renaissance. That was a Sunday. Monday, they both won the Pulitzer Prize. So Ballard's working on a book, and I'm a little concerned. Anyway, this is the beginning of my Cub Losers Tour. In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be with the Ernie Banks book at the Hall of Fame's Author Series in Cooperstown, talking about the 1969 season. This is the 50th anniversary of 1969, the Cubs' epic loss to the amazing Mets. That is not the adjective they use in Chicago. And now here I am talking about the 84. But I did, 84 Cubs, I did look up some of the things that I had written, and I'd like to take you back to what it was like in Chicago. You talked about walking down the beach and you could hear it. The Cubs won, clinched early too. I don't think they won by 12 games. But their final home game was sort of a victory lap against the Cardinals. And they won. And, okay, it's over now. They're on to San Diego to win the World Series. It was the first playoff they'd been in since 39 years earlier. The fans would not leave the ballpark. They just weren't going to go home. They wanted to savor this moment. Stood and cheered and cheered and cheered. And Jimmy Fry, manager of the Cubs, had this... just all of a sudden said, all right, boys, let's go out on the field. And everybody in the dugout went out and started walking around the ballpark, shaking hands with the fans. Well, the word got into the locker room. And the players who had left early and were in their locker room, they came out, too, in their shower clogs and T-shirts. I mean, it was an amazing moment. Now, you know, and then somebody called Ernie, who was living in California. I got to read to you what he said. I mean, this is the first time in his adult life that the Cubs had a chance to go to the World Series. He'd lived through all that misery when he was the best player, most productive power hitter in baseball for many years on teams that finished 20 games out every year. And now, okay, he wasn't playing anymore, but he was going to have this chance. So they said, how do you feel? And he said, once you step off the sidelines, you still hold on to it. You don't want to let go. My team is there. My team has a chance to be in the World Series. I'm going to pick one player and follow him. I'm going to follow Leon Durham. Bad choice, Ernie, bad choice. But that's the way it was in Chicago.
We'll talk a little bit more about Leon Durham in a little while.
I think so.
So that was the Chicago viewpoint. And while I'm traveling with the team, Bill Center did some traveling with the Padres that year, but mostly was handling things in San Diego. Bill, what was it like from your viewpoint in San Diego?
Well, it was magical. And back then, like you said earlier, radio ruled. Games were not seen every day on TV. The limited television coverage of the ball club on local TV, and so radio ruled. And it was fantastic. You'd walk through a mall, you'd walk through Mission Valley, and you'd have people with radios on listening to Padre games. And that always struck me because for the first decade of this franchise's history, not quite the first decade, because things had turned around once Ray took over, but there was absolutely no interest in the Padres. I was at opening day. I actually, 1969, I had just sort of come out of the service, and opening day, there were only 21,000 people at for the first game ever in Padres history, there were 21,000. And it went downhill from there. I can remember there were days when they only drew 3,000 in the first years, and this club was actually sold to interests in Washington, D.C. in 1973. And were it not for a city attorney named John Witt, the Padres would have gone to Washington, D.C. Witt filed some of the more brilliant lawsuits ever in the summer of 1973 after the Padres were purchased by a man named Joseph Danzanski. He did not file a suit saying you can't move the team. In fact, he said, when you move the team, you're going to owe us rent for the next 30 years. You're also going to owe us for parking and concessions that we'll figure out as we go along. And that made the Washington, Joseph Danzanski, the new owner, he sort of did a big-time blink and pulled out. And that's what really saved the team being here.
You can imagine what a San Diego jury might decide the value of a team is for 15 more years. Yeah, San Diego is actually in limbo as a team, much like the Montreal Expos were when they were in Washington. They were just being operated. And they were going to be operated by the National League in 1974 until this fellow named Ray Kroc, according to the story he told me, Ballard, he's on his yacht off Florida with his wife Joan, and he picks up the newspaper and he's reading that the Padres are for sale. And he turned to Joan, who was not a big baseball fan at that time, and said, "Joan, I think I'm going to buy the Padres." And she looked at him kind of funny and said, "Well, Ray, why would you want to buy a monastery?"
You know what? One of the greatest questions ever asked Ray Kroc. Ray Kroc has this press conference to announce that he's bought the Padres. And we had a writer named Jerry McGee. And everybody's asking these questions about how much did it cost and you know, all your love of baseball. And McGee puts his hands up and asks, "How'd you get a newspaper on your yacht off Florida?"
Kurt Bavacqua was a key member of that 1984 team. He was the number one pinch hitter. He was one of those guys that helped keep things loose in the clubhouse. And Kurt, I don't know about you, but I thought the feeling during spring training 84 was that this was a really good team that had a chance to make some noise. And then on the last day of spring training, the Padres made a deal for Greg Nettles to come in and play third base. And that was the one position people were wondering about. And I thought the clubhouse went, "Wow, we've got a chance to win this." How did you feel?
Yeah, I was real happy when we got Nettles because third base was my primary position.
I was thinking the same thing.
That's my job. I'm a setup man.
So I'm really glad to be here with the gentleman seated to my left, Bob also. As you can tell, he doesn't need to do research. When he talks to groups, he just knows everything right off the top of his head, and you can probably tell that. If you've kind of glanced at me during these guys talking, I've made some notes, and there's certain things that I want to touch on as the hour progresses, but I think Ron being here is very coincidental with my career also. He comes from the city of Chicago. Chicago probably did more to kill my career than any other city in the league.
I'm sorry.
In 1988, they finally got lights. I tried to go back and make the ball club. You know, I have dreams that I've gone back and I've made ball clubs. You know, as a pinch hitter, because
more,
I still
like nightmares,
believe I can do it. But we all know that the Wrigley Field didn't get lights until 1988. My last year was 1986. So as we all know during the 84 season, little did we know that the commissioner of baseball started to have meetings with the owners to talk about collusion. And that's another thing that we might touch on today, because it's a thorn in my side. It's something that I was involved with. Ballard was the spokesman for the owner of the San Diego Padres, which was Joan at the time, because like Bill said, Ray had passed away in January of that year. It was really too bad, because I tell you what, Ray was a crotchety old guy, but looking back at things, he was one person that I wish could have been there to see that in 1984 of us coming back and shocking Chicago, shocking certainly the fans of Chicago, and bringing the city of San Diego together like it was never brought together before, and I don't think has brought together since. 98 was a great year here, but that celebration and that win, those wins that they had that year weren't nearly, I don't believe, up to where 1984 was. Like Bill said, it was all radio. Now it's a little bit different. You get to see these guys every single day at one time or another. And back then it was, you know, the NBC game of the week, ESPN was just starting. So it was a different time. But we thank you for coming, and Bob, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, I'm going to come right back to you, Kurt, because there are certain things we have to talk about in 1984, and one of them was a game in Atlanta Fulton County Stadium in the middle of August of 1984. The Padres had like a 10-game lead over the Atlanta Braves, and they're playing Atlanta, and our leadoff hitter, Alan Wiggins, was starting the game for San Diego, and on the mound for the Atlanta Braves was a pitcher named Pascual Perez. And the first pitch he threw was a fastball buried right in the ribs of Alan Wiggins. Now, the Padres felt, that, at least from the ones I talked to, that Joe Torre, who was the manager of the Braves at that time, was trying to send a message, trying to intimidate the Padres, and this was his way of starting it. And the Padres spent the next 9 innings trying to hit Pascual Perez in return. The Padres ended up with at least 4 different managers that day because they kept getting the pitcher and the manager kicked out of the game. Although the original home plate umpire did give the Padres a little leeway to go after Pascual Perez when he came up. Even though he was standing this far away from home plate, he knew what was happening. And then the biggest brawl I've ever seen in baseball broke out. And Kurt, what do you remember about that?
Well, it gave me an opportunity to get on the field. Naturally, we talk about that. People ask me about that all the time, and that was one of the better days of my career. I mean, I literally spent almost the whole game on the field. It was so much fun. And the reason it was is because really nobody got seriously hurt. But when we left that ballpark that day, we knew that we were going to win the National League West. We knew it. We knew that we had what Bob called good chemistry going into spring training in 1984. But I think that day proved it, because if you look back at the film, and boy, it's easy to find, trust me. I see it all the time on social media. I see people pull it up all the time. There's 2 things that are pulled up on social media all the time with me. It's the Atlanta fight. And it's the big fat ass Italian up in LA, so Lasorda's tape on me. So those 2 things are what I see almost on a daily basis, somewhere, somehow. So explaining things out on how things transpired before that happened was, Wiggins was hit. He had gotten 3 hits, I think, the night before, and a couple of them of the bunt base hit variety. And I don't think Joe Torre that day had anything to do with that. I think that was 100% Pascual Perez. Players from Latin America are not afraid to knock guys down. I spent 10 years playing winter ball in various places like the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, and Venezuela. And you get knocked down a lot. And it was part of the game. And I'd be surprised if they're still not knocking guys down in those leagues, even though the leagues are much different. But Pascual Perez, Dominican players in particular, are not afraid to pitch inside. And Pascual Perez was one of those guys. He didn't just try to pitch Wiggins inside. He literally tried to hit him. So I wasn't in the lineup that day, and I went to instigating right away. And I went to Royster was playing at that time for the Atlanta Braves, and Terry Kennedy and Whitson were talking, and they were going to retaliate against Royster, who was the leadoff hitter. And I said, he's in left field, has no idea what's going on. I go, let's wait and get Perez, because
that's it. That must be 11 o'clock.
You were right, Bill.
Earthquake.
Bill told me, this always happens when I speak.
People running for the exits?
Yes.
You know.
So we started right away on the bench with retaliation. And Dick Williams was not in on the conversation. I can tell you that right now, because I was right there. It was Terry Kennedy, it was Ed Whitson, and it was Flan kind of scooted over on the bench, and I walked down there because I knew what they were talking about. So the decision was made to wait for Pascual Perez. Well, by that time, 2.5 innings later, the Atlanta Braves nor Pascual Perez had no idea that there was going to be any retaliation. As a matter of fact, Royster stepped almost out of the right-handed batter's box on the first pitch of the game because he thought he was going to get drilled. When it didn't happen, they just figured we were going to go on our merry way, thought it was an errant pitch, and nothing was going to become of it until the first pitch from Whitson when Pascual Perez came up. And that's when it all started because he had no idea. He went down like soft mud in the rain. And both benches kind of went out on the field. Perez did his little dance around with his bat. His bat never left his hand all three times that he got thrown at. But we didn't get to him, and really nothing broke out that particular at-bat. Then I went to instigating again. Because both managers were told that if anybody gets knocked down or hit, that they were gone, and the pitcher was gone. So when Dick got back to the bench, I started talking about how they were trying to get our catalyst out of the lineup and that we had a 6-game lead in the National League West, and that would seriously do harm to that lead that we had. So the next thing I know, Dick starts calling over all the coaches. And he goes, Ozzie, you're the next manager. Jack, you're the manager after him. And get, this was the best part. He goes, get the bullpen up. So, everybody knew what was going to happen when the bullpen started throwing because they had only scored like one run off of Whitson. And it's the third inning. So, that whole thing, and then from then on, every time Pascual Perez came to the plate, there was some type of an altercation on the field involving both teams. Bob Horner was on a disabled list for the Atlanta Braves. He was up in the press box. By the fifth inning, I think it was, he was fully dressed and down on the field in his cast. And who finally hits Pascual Perez?
I can tell you.
Craig Leffers.
Craig Leffers.
Who, if he threw a ball at that screen, it wouldn't crack it. So we've got Goose in the bullpen. We've got Whitson, who's been out of the game for a long time. We got Booker, who got kicked out of the game also, who threw at him. These guys throw pretty good. They just couldn't hit him. But from the first pitch, his first time up, he was kind of running when the pitcher got to about right here. He was running out of the batter's box because he knew what was going to happen. But we were never able to get to him. Champ Summers and I tried real hard to get to Pascual Perez, but it was difficult. If you watch the video, Champ did try to go into their dugout one time, and that's when Horner appeared. Because Pascual Perez had ran into the Atlanta dugout. Champ followed him. And then next thing you know, here comes Bob Horner out of the dugout. And that was really the worst part of the fight because Atlanta fans jumped out of the stands and out of from the top of their dugout on to Champ Summers. And that's when I really saw some guys that I think brought this team together that everybody else saw that were leaders already. And nobody had to tell them that they weren't leaders. But I actually saw Gwynn and Garvey getting down and dirty in that fight. Gwynn body slammed one of the players. I don't know who it was. And Garv's uniform actually got dirty. Which an amazing thing. He had the ability, when he came to San Diego, to be able to slide on the brown stripe. And the white part of his pants never got dirty. It was amazing.
I think you can see now why Kurt was a key guy on that 84 team. But from the owner's standpoint, what do you remember about that, Ballard?
Well, let me just preface this by saying that Kurt and I are great friends. But that day, I wanted to kill him. I was at Disneyland with my four young daughters standing in line at the Jungle Cruise listening to my transistor radio as they're talking about Kurt Bavakwa going up into the stands.
That wasn't until the end, though.
I mean, obviously the concern from my standpoint was we're in a pennant race and somebody's going to get hurt. Fortunately, no one did. And I don't know, did we end up paying your fine that day?
You did. I didn't get fined for going in the stands, you know. There was a, what was it, 17 players? Bill?
All told.
I think there were 17 players ejected. And
both managers, four coaches.
And not Joe Torre.
Did he get?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because when it was all over, in the seventh inning when we finally got, when Leffers hit Pascual Perez, we think it's all over. Craig Nettles is our leadoff hitter. He's in the on-deck circle, and he's taking his practice swings, putting his pine tar on his bat, doing the whole ball of wax to get ready for his AB. And he walks back towards the dugout, and he says to me, he goes, "Get ready." I go, "What are you talking about? We already got him." He goes, "The guy coming in from the bullpen right now, I hit him during one of the fights." So here comes Donnie Moore in from the bullpen, and sure enough, he hits Nettles right on the ass with the first pitch. And here we go again. And nobody was expecting that except Nettles, and he told me, and I wasn't really sure whether he said was going to be true or not. But sure enough, as soon as Moore hit him, he went out to the mound, and it started all over again.
People forget that the benches emptied three times in seven innings.
Mm-hmm.
Second, fifth, and seventh.
Yeah, we had some good ones. There were some good ones going on out there.
Can I just say that this explains a lot to me, because it's very clear that this kind of passion energized the fans as well. The Padre fans that year. I just want to tell you about the Cubs win the first two games of the playoffs, okay? And they come to San Diego, and they're riding high. They got to only win one more, 3 out of 5, right? And the assistant public relations man on that Cubs team was somebody whose name you will know, Ned Colletti. Went on to become, work his way through the ranks, from assistant PR guy of the Cubs to general manager of the Dodgers. And I talked to Ned, and he said, I'm going to read to you again, "We're going to the ballpark, we're thinking we're going to crush these guys. The team bus pulls up into the parking lot, and the fans refuse to let the bus move. They're all around the thing. They're just standing there screaming and yelling, holding up teddy bears. Remember Cub Busters? It was Ghostbusters that year. So everybody had Cub Busters t-shirts. They were knifing teddy bears and beating them with sticks. And Ned says, "We ain't afraid of no Cubs." You know, the Ghostbusters lyrics. And it was a parody of the theme song for them. And the t-shirts were such popular attire. The bus just had to sit there. They couldn't move into the ballpark. Now, they're still confident. But the game is not about to begin. And the way Ned described it was, the dugouts were not dug out. They were on the same level as the field. And two of the Padres, he didn't remember who, come out before the game and start screaming and yelling and raising their towels and going on. And the Cubs were, and the noise was huge. It was gigantic.
Yeah, Gary Templeton.
Gary Templeton. Mm-hmm. Well, the Cubs, they were familiar with noise in Wrigley Field, cheers, you know, all kinds of things, but nothing like this. It was amazing. And here are the things that you forget. I was talking to my daughter driving down here yesterday, said where I was going to be, and she said, "Well, you know, you brought me home a Cub Busters t-shirt." I said, why would I do that? Well, the idea was it was going to be a collector's item. I mean, the Cubs were going to crush him. 3-0. And she'd have this funny thing to wear around town. She said, Dad, I couldn't wear it out of the house. I used it for a nightshirt. I used it to sleep in, the Cubbuster T-shirt. It might be still around there. But this kind of passion that was on the field was just huge with the
I have a couple of things I want to give you before you leave town, Ron.
Actually, you know,
I knew more people in Chicago than I did in San Diego. And the reason for that was because the games got over about 4:30. And from that time until game time the next day, I was meeting people somehow. I knew a lot of bartenders, knew a lot of maitre d's. I used to go out every night with Garv because he'd draw the crowds. And then the people would get scared away from him and come to me. It was perfect. So I literally felt sorry for the city of Chicago when we won that series because I know how crushed people were. And I still have beer mugs that a friend of mine sent me from one of the establishments on Rush Street. I have 4 beer mugs that says 1984 National League champion, Chicago Cubs.
Talk about collector's items, right?
They had those printed up, and he sent them to me. And I still have a couple of them are a little worn, are getting worn, but I still have a couple of them in a bin that I was surprised to get, for one thing. But that's the kind of thing that you never forget in your life. I mean, it was... Ron said they won the first 2 games. They didn't just win the first 2 games. They kicked our butt.
13-0 was the first game.
Right.
I mean, coming back in the plane, we had no chance. We had no chance. The plane was dead. The players, there was no uppity in anybody's voice. You know that.
Well, I was at San Diego Stadium waiting for you guys to, and that I want to make that point.
That's when it started.
Yes, exactly. The pandemonium of the last 3 days, or the last 4 days, because there was an off day, of that series started the night that the Padres lost the second game in Chicago. They flew back to San Diego, and their plane had been delayed, taking off for an hour, because the air traffic control in Chicago let the Cubs go first, although they weren't even at the airport when the Padres had loaded. So you guys were already stewing. So you're delayed an hour. I guess the plane was like 30 minutes late after that. The Padres bus to then Jack Murphy Stadium. And as the buses come in, as they approach the parking lot, they're delayed again because there are 20,000 fans in the parking lot waiting to greet this team that had just lost 2 games in Chicago back. And it was pandemonium. It was crazy.
The fans were just on fire. Do you know that after it was all over, now the Padres win, the fans are the Cubs fans were there, and they're yelling at him, 40 more years, 40 more years. It just about was until I finally got to the World Series.
There were so many people at that. You guys couldn't get off the buses at first because the doors could not open in the parking lot.
No, it's clear to me that after losing 0-2 and coming home not feeling too strong, and here are the fans that have a different attitude, and they intimidated the Cubs. It's very clear.
That's when the handkerchief waving started.
Right.
At night.
Yeah.
It started. I remember a vivid picture of Ballard and one of his daughters that night. You were holding her in your arms. And I remember somewhere along the line, I remember seeing a picture of you in that crowd of people where they were separated from us, but it was craziness. I mean, it was.
You know, Bill, you mentioned the importance of radio back then, and our radio station was KFMB, and they're the ones that promoted fans going to the ballpark, and it was because of their efforts that all those fans ended up there.
And it might be noted that, as you mentioned, we were a couple hours late getting back, and the fans had a lot of time to get lubricated before the team arrived, which helped in the raucousness.
The air traffic controller might have helped you, yeah.
I'll never forget the players coming out. It was a screened-in area, and Dick Williams on a scooter zipping around and high-fiving the fans, and the players all came. It sounds kind of corny, but you had to be there to see it, and you could literally see the spirits of the players lifted by that that reaction.
But the players trying to leave the ballpark that night by their by car, they would just went nowhere. I mean, there were fans every time a player left that gated area and got their car out into the parking lot. It was surrounded by thousands of fans. It was crazy.
So the Cubs are up 2-0. Now, in 1984, you had just two divisions. The Eastern Division, Cubs won it. Western Division, the Padres won it. You play a best 3 out of 5 series, winner goes to the World Series. So the Cubs are up 2-0. As Ron mentioned, one more victory, they're in the World Series. And the Padres won that first game. The second game, in San Diego, a guy named Garvey came up in the bottom of the ninth. He had already singled twice and doubled with 2 outs to drive in runs in his 3 previous at-bats. And with the score tied against Lee Smith, hit the home run over the right center field fence and sent San Diego into delirium. There was one other home run in the World Series that was hit by somebody at the table here to win the only World Series game the Padres ever won. But going back to that Cubs series, after Garvey hit that homer, now it's even at 2 games apiece, but the Padres had to face the hottest pitcher in baseball in the next game, Rick Sutcliffe. The Cubs made a great trade in getting Sutcliffe. He was 16-1 with Chicago after coming over from Cleveland, and he had the Padres shut out for 5 innings in Game 5 of that playoff series, and the Cubs were leading 3-0. And then, Kurt, the players told me that they thought Sutcliffe started to lose a little off his fastball in the 6th inning.
Yeah, he did. Ron, I've never asked anybody this before, and being from Chicago, you would know. Was there any talk of what I feel was the decision that almost gave us the National League Championship Series when Jim Fry decided to hold Sutcliffe back as a starter in Game 4 to Game 5?
There was a lot of talk then. But okay, now here he is in the game with this lead. He'd won 17 games in a row. He'd beaten the Padres twice during the regular season. And he was gassed. He's looking, Ned told me this, he's looking at Fry in the dugout as if to say, what's Fry going to do? He's his ace. He's the guy that's done it all year long. He leaves him in. But here's the other thing. The game was going too fast. This is a clinching game to go to the World Series. It was over in 2 hours and 41 minutes. The Cubs, it was moving too fast. They couldn't slow it down. There were some 10-pitch innings. They'd get up after the Padres went ahead. And it was like, it was over. Like they couldn't wait to, they didn't know what to do. They were swinging at everything. They were getting the ball going. There was no, stop, let's go, wait a minute, we're better than this. Let's regroup. You know the famous moment in the 2016 World Series where there was this rain delay and Jason Hayes does this kind of stuff. There was nobody to do that then. It was almost like this inevitable thing, we're going to win it. Coming, you know, we've won the first two. Now was inevitable. Sutcliffe blows the lead. Did they leave him in too long? Should they have pitched him in Game 4? All that stuff. And now there's nothing they can do. And all of a sudden it goes from, we're definitely going to win, to these guys are going to beat us. You know? It was amazing how back then you would have said, typical Cub, find a way to lose the big game. They had everything going for them. They lost.
Sure did.
There was a theory, though, that Jim Fry was thinking that the Padres were going to go down, and he was saving Sutcliffe for the first game of the World Series.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Right. That was some of the thinking, and it was never really explained out, but he pushed him back a day. The thinking was, well, he was actually trying to save him
right.
for the first game of the World Series.
You could almost not blame him. 2-0, and they were so outplaying.
Yeah, but look at Cub history.
Well, he just added to it. 40 more years.
You know, the Padres and the Cubs played 17 times in 1984, and the Cubs won 8 of the games, and the Padres won 9. These were two pretty evenly matched teams, though the difference may have been the one ace in Sutcliffe, and the Cubs had him for that fifth game. But Leon Durham, who you mentioned, in the seventh inning of that fifth game, the Cubs are leading by a score of 3-2. Padres have a runner at second with one out, and Tim Flannery hit a ground ball to Leon Durham at first, and it went through his legs, and the tying run scored. So people blame Durham. I mean, he made an error, no question, for losing the World Series. However, even if he makes that play, it's only the second out, and there's a runner at third, and the next two batters were Allen Wiggins and Tony Gwynn. Wiggins singled, and Gwynn hit a rocket that went through Sandberg all the way to the fence in right center field, and that was really the hit that drove in the winning runs. Then Garvey got a hit to drive in Gwynn, and that was it, 6-3. It ended that way.
Did Garvey get his uniform dirty that day?
Only
with his teammates patting him on the back, and he got his number retired at San Diego Stadium because of that.
I jumped all over Garv as soon as he got to spring training in Yuma the first year. I wanted his image to go down quick. So him and I become fast friends. I got T-shirts made. Remember the T-shirts I got made that Steve Garvey was my shadow? And I passed them out. I was thinking about that this morning coming here, and I don't remember having those T-shirts made and how they got made and who printed them up. The whole deal, I don't remember. And it was amazing because there was hundreds of them around the ballpark in Yuma, and Garvey hated them. He absolutely hated them. It was fun. We had a good time with him. And he really became an intricate part of the ball club. And when he hit that home run off of Lee Smith, that was a crushing blow for the Cubs.
Well, beating the Cubs, of course, put the Padres in the World Series, which opened up in San Diego against the Detroit Tigers, a Tigers team that had started that year 35-5 and was led by a shortstop named Alan Trammell, who graduated from high school in San Diego and still lives here. A terrific guy, ended up being the MVP of that World Series. But the Padres have played 9 World Series games in their history, and they've lost 8 of them. The only one they won was Game 2 against the Detroit Tigers. Now, against the Cubs, the one negative in the Garvey game that won Game 4 was that Kevin McReynolds, the starting center fielder and one of our power sources, slid into second to try to break up a double play and broke his wrist. So he not only missed Game 5 against the Cubs, but he missed the World Series. And that opened things up because in that year, they alternated whether the DH was used in the World Series or not, and that was a DH year. So Bobby Brown played center field, and Kurt Bavacqua became the designated hitter and hit a 3-run homer to win the second game of the World Series, the only World Series game the Padres have ever won. And Kurt, I wonder if you could describe your trip around the bases, which took several minutes.
Took several minutes because I had to go retouch the bases 4 times. I had talked to Garv about the home run against Lee Smith, you know, days before that, and what his feelings were going around the bases. And he said, Kurt, he says, you know, I've hit some home runs before this one. He goes, but for some reason, this one was different. It was almost like I went into a vacuum. And he didn't hear the cheering. He didn't hear the crowd for a matter of seconds rounding the bases at one time or another. And the exact same thing happened to me when I hit that home run that night. I do not remember approaching second base and rounding second base until I got to almost third, and Ozzie Virgil was the third base coach, and I remember reaching out to give him 5.
But it was a strange experience because, you know, it was like there was nobody there but me. From after I did some kind of a loop-de-loop going to first base, jumping up when I saw that the ball left the ballpark, and when I got a little bit past that area, from there almost to third base, it was like there was nothing. And it was really strange, and it was almost the same thing that Garvin explained to me. So, you know, funny things happen to funny people. I remember Kurt Gibson going around the bases and doing this in a home run that he hit, I believe, off of Dennis Eckersley in a big game for the Dodgers when he went up and pinch hit and he was crippled one game. And I talked to Kurt about that just a year or two ago, and he goes, you know what, Kurt, I don't even remember that. I go, really? So, you know, I guess it happens to a lot of us. You know, you're put into that situation, and for whatever reason, you just don't remember certain aspects of it. But I knew that I was swinging the bat well. The game before, it kind of ticked me off. As good as the Detroit Tigers were, I believe that series could have been turned around if I hadn't gotten thrown out at third base in game one. Because there was a possibility that we were losing that game 3-2, and I got thrown out at third base with no outs, trying to go from second to third. In my defense, if there's any, we had just gone over what we were going to do if we had the opportunity to run on Kirk Gibson at right field. And that was to run on him because he never hit the cutoff man. That was the book on him. I hit a double down into the right field corner. Gibson goes over and gets it. He comes up. I'm approaching second base. I decide to go. Gibson comes up and throws a perfect relay throw to Lou Whitaker at second. Lou Whitaker would have never thrown to third base if it wasn't for the fans of San Diego. So I blame them. Because they were cheering so loud when I rounded second and started going to third, Whitaker knew I was going, and he just turned and threw a perfect strike to the third baseman, and I was out. You never get thrown out at third base with no outs or two outs, especially in a 3-2 game. The game was 3-2, so naturally I'm the go to that game when all of these guys came into the clubhouse. And when I left that ballpark that night, I was upset as much with myself as with being the go to the game. And I vowed to my wife that night that I was going to do something about this game for the rest of the series. And you know what? I lived up to my word.
You did.
I had a pretty good series. You know, faced Morris again, who was a hell of a pitcher that year, and hit a double off of him in Detroit. I faced Dan Petrie a couple of times in that series and got hits off of him, including the three-run homer. Faced Willie Hernandez in a relief role who won the Cy Young Award that year and took him into the upper deck in Detroit. I wanted to play 15 more games in that series because I was seeing the ball well, I was swinging the bat well, and we were having one heck of a time. But in retrospect, I think we might have been happy just to be there and not have gone into that series with a winning type attitude that I'm sure the Detroit Tigers had, because they had one heck of a team from the get-go. As been said, they were, you know, broke out of the gate at 35-4 or something like that, and they expected to be there.
Yeah.
I don't think we
sure,
did.
We only have a minute left, so just one last.
Going anywhere? What
are
you?
I'm sure you can answer this in less than a minute, but somebody wants to know why Tommy Lasorda said those things about you.
Because it takes more than a minute. Yeah. Are there more people coming in here?
Yeah.
Because if there's not, we'll just stay, right?
our time is up. Our time is up.
See, I told you that.
Thanks to Kurt, Bill Center.
I got one thing to say. The Padres have been in two World Series, 84 and 98. And you can look it up, history, that the two teams they lost to, many people believe that the 98 Yankees might be the best team ever in baseball, and the 84 Tigers are ranked in the top 10. That's sort of the draw of the Padres. The two times they got there, they ran into two of the best teams in baseball history.
Ron Rappaport, thanks for the minority view here up in Chicago.
My lot in life, ladies and gentlemen.
And Ballard Smith, the president of the Padres at that time. Listen, it's like... It's like preaching to the choir with this group, and I know you'll enjoy Petco Park. It's a gorgeous facility, and I think you're going to enjoy a guy I consider a generational player, this young shortstop, Fernando Tatis Jr., and you make up your own mind when you watch him over the next 3 days against the Cardinals. Thanks very much.